This is Positive Outcomes, a podcast for the OMP community. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Simon Beals. I'm your host for this episode. We have a great show for you today. We're going to be joined by Jamie McMillan of Healing Mother, who's with us, and we're going to discuss the importance of innovation to provide better patient outcomes. Jamie McMillan is an occupational therapist with her certification in hand therapy. She also plays a pivotal role in upper extremity product development as a director with Healing Weber and has numerous patents under her belt. Welcome, Jamie.
Thank you, Simon.
Really appreciate you taking the time out for out of your busy schedule to be able to join us for this. So first off, let's kind of start at the very beginning under your credentials. So OTR-CHT. Why don't we start with that? What are those credentials?
Sure. OTR is Occupational Therapist Registered, which I have a bachelor's in occupational therapy, and the registration is in good standing with licensure. And CHT, Certified Hand Therapist, is a certification that is available above and beyond your licensure, available to physical therapists or occupational therapists who want to specialize in hand therapy and take the steps to gain the credentialing, which requires you to be a licensed therapist for at least 3 years, have at least 4,000 hours of direct hand care, and then you have to successfully pass a pretty comprehensive test in regards to the upper extremity quadrant. So it's pretty rigorous. And then we're required to recertify every 5 years to make sure that we keep up on continuing ed and are current with our understanding in upper extremity.
Excellent. So scope of practice, how I think probably most of us are familiar with kind of occupational therapy. How does that vary? How does kind of the occupational therapy scope of practice compared to kind of scope as a registered, as a certified hand therapist?
Sure. So occupational therapy is such a cool field because you can work in so many arenas. I've always felt like the door is just wide open when you're in OT because our focus as an occupational therapist is independence. So what we're trying to do is promote independence for people within their occupation. And occupation can be kind of a deceiving word because people immediately think about somebody's job. But we think of occupations as anything that we do that makes us who we are. So your occupation could be your activities of daily living, you know, independently taking care of yourself, grooming, bathing, feeding, to more specific occupations such as the skills that it takes to show up at an actual job or to drive or to cook or more complicated things. So it's anything, our occupations are anything that we do that makes us who we are. And so OT is such a broad field where we help people regain and keep their independence. And so that could take place anywhere in the schools where we're, you know, working with children so that they can independently write or draw or answer questions. It happens in adult rehab. It happens in neuro following strokes and brain injuries. It happens in geriatric care where we're trying to, you know, prolong independence and maintain independence towards end of life. There's just so many arenas where OTs can work. And so it's a really wide open, interesting field in that regard. Hand therapy is a very, very specialized piece of that. So I very much still call on my OT background while using my CHT credentials. And so what that really means is now we hyper focus on the upper quadrant and finger to shoulder tip. And so it becomes a lot more biomechanical in theory and nature, but still our ultimate goal is to bring independence to our patients, you know, healing from whatever injury or getting through the post-op period or whatever it might be to bring people back to a baseline state of independence.
Okay. And is there a reason why you kind of felt drawn into the hand therapy segment within the profession?
Sure. For me, it was my personality just lends itself to the concrete nature of science and that black and white space. I thrive in that understanding of things. So it was a really great fit for me to work in that more biomechanical arena where a bone breaks and they fix it and we can expect how long that's going to take to heal, and your protocols are outlined and, you know, there's a pretty understood path to healing and recovery versus when you work with, let's just say, a child with autism or cerebral palsy, and you're trying to teach them to use a switch to gain independence for communication. And that is just a much more gray area where some days you might feel like you're making great progress, and then the next day it doesn't feel so much like that. And it's a much more complicated path sometimes to that learning or recovery. And I think it's just a personality thing for me that I jived better with that more concrete path versus the very less understood path that's involved in some of the other arenas.
Right. So within kind of daily practice, you know, and I'm not even sure kind of where you were practicing, where in the U.S. are you based or were based?
I went to school in North Dakota, and then I interned in Southern Utah and Washington State. I spent the first 5 years of practice in a private practice clinic in Spokane, Washington. And then I moved back home to Montana, which is where I was born and raised, and worked in a large physician-owned practice where I was fortunate to work hand-in-hand, no pun intended, with my hand surgeons for 10 years prior to then changing gears and moving into industry. And so that the bulk of that, you know, my clinical time was spent in Montana.
Okay. So describe for me kind of daily practice. What are some of the tools that you would have used or had at your disposal for kind of patient management?
Sure. So we, you know, everything was based on evaluation and then plan of care and meeting goals. So that was, you know, sort of what we went through with each person that we served. And so evaluation tools vary from, you know, testing muscle strength to grip strength, pinch strength, lots of measuring of range of motion, of joint motion. Sensory diagnoses where we're testing, you know, 2-point discrimination and sharp dull and things like that. And then functional use of the hand or arm, what somebody can and can't do. And then identifying what the goals are, what is important for that patient at the end of care? What is it that they want to be able to independently complete? And so then the intervention really comes as a result of that evaluation and goal setting with the patient. And we would use all kinds of different things for intervention, from, you know, manual therapy, joint mobilization, stretching, strengthening, functional activities, stacking, sorting, reaching, all kinds of things that we would use to achieve those goals.
Okay. So at that point, was that kind of your first introduction to kind of upper extremity orthotic devices? Did that enter into your practice?
Sure. Shame on me for missing. That's a huge component of hand therapy and practice as a hand therapist is orthoses. And so one of the things that many hand therapists love and are very good at are custom fabricated bracing and splinting. And so we are very skilled at using thermoplastics or functional casting and custom making any variety of braces. When I started my practice, I'm going to age myself, 20 years ago, there were prefabricated off-the-shelf braces, certainly, but they weren't very exciting. There were a lot of shortcomings to them, but we did use them. There were also important things that came with prefabricated braces. Neoprenes were great to offer some compression and warmth, but by and large, we use a lot of custom fabricated braces in many cases. And so right from the very start, my first intern, I had a rapid introduction to orthoses in hand therapy.
So that was your first kind of introduction to it. So describe kind of the evolution that took you from clinical practice, you know, and an exposure to devices to actually kind of the path you've taken to now being involved with Healy & Weber and actually being on the developmental side of new devices.
Sure. So I love custom fabrication, and it was one of my favorite parts of my practice, and I did so much of it. And yet there were certain diagnoses or certain problems that patients had that I never loved what my bracing options were. And so the very first one that comes to mind was ulnar-sided wrist pain. And I would tend to be a magnet for these particular group of patients. And they were very hard to treat. It wasn't always a well-understood diagnosis. And these patients are oftentimes young and active, and they want to continue to live their life and do their things. And so they're looking for a solution. They're looking for an answer. And I would try custom fabricated options, and they would be too rigid or dig in or put pressure over the ulnar styloid. And then finally, a prefabricated option came to the market. And I remember being very excited about it and ordering some and trying them on my patients, but so many of the patients couldn't tolerate the circumferential design. And so in order to get enough support where they were getting relief, we were creating kind of a tourniquet around the wrist. And so it was like this double-edged sword. And so it was through patient care and experience and lots of feedback that I one day said to myself, basically, we have to be able to do this better. Like, there's got to be a solution for this. And so that's where my wheels first started turning, to know that the solution was not going to be made out of thermoplastic, and I needed to figure out a way to do it with textiles. And that's when I decided to connect with Healy & Weber. I had met Jim Weber a number of years before that, and so had the opportunity to do some collaboration and brought him the idea. And that was the first time that I was able to work together with them and bring my first product to market.
So do you still remember what that first product was?
Oh, of course. So the product is called the Squeeze Ulnar Compression Wrap, and it's a very simple design used to treat ulnar-sided wrist pain. It's different from anything else on the market because though you look at it and it looks like a wristlet, which is circumferential naturally in design, its support comes from a non-circumferential tension. And so that's what kind of sets it apart, allows us to stabilize the ulnar side of the wrist without creating that tourniquet-like compression. So it was a very fun project, a great sense of accomplishment to go through the entire process and understand how, you know, identifying a need in the clinic for my patients to do something better, and then working through the channels of engineering and testing and manufacturing and being able to bring it to market and see it on a shelf was really fun.
And is the Squeeze still a product?
It is. Yep. It is still available from Healy & Weber.
Excellent. So, you know, interested to hear kind of what other things, devices, you know, solutions that you've been involved with over the over the years with Helium Weber?
So the Squeeze was the very first product I worked on, and it was about 2 years from, hey, Jim, I have an idea, to launching it. And we got that product launch, and Jim reached out and he said, do you have any other ideas? And my next idea was also came from a clinical need. So I was frequently referred patients who needed a sugar tongue or a Munster splint fabricated. And as much as I
love... Okay, so I'm going to interrupt you for a second. What's that? Sounds interesting. What's that?
So a sugar tongue or a Munster is a brace that crosses the elbow and the wrist to control wrist flexion extension and forearm rotation, but it doesn't immobilize the elbow. So the name sugar tong comes from, if you can imagine a small sugar tong that you pick up sugar cubes with. So that's kind of that is the shape and design of a sugar tong. It would wrap around the back of the elbow, go from palm to back of the hand around the back of the elbow. Munster is just kind of a deviation of that, achieving the same goal.
Interesting. So,
fabricating that product took quite a bit of time, a large piece of thermoplastic. It, you know, thermoplastic dries quite rigid, and you're taking that rigidity right around that elbow where you have some more bony prominences and areas that are prone to irritation. And so I always felt like my very, very best sugar tong, I wouldn't have even wanted to wear. And so I found myself oftentimes explaining through the entire process of fabrication, like the importance of it and educating the patient on why we were doing this, and validating them that we knew it wasn't super comfortable and that it was bulky and cumbersome, but why it was so important that they were compliant and wore it. And so circle back to Jim saying, do you have any other ideas? And that was the only thing that was just really at the forefront of my mind, was thinking, we have to be able to do something better for these poor patients that we're putting in these rigid sugar tongs and Munsters and irritating their elbows, and they're heavy and they're expensive and they're take so much time to fabricate. And so we set off to develop a prefabricated option. And 2 years later, through a very similar design process and development, we launched the MTC fracture brace. That was the final product that I did independently, kind of as a consultant with Helium Weber. It was not too long after that product launched that then I came over and am now a full-time employee here. And so since then, I've been involved in many of our products that have since launched, some of them including the Tiny Castaway and the Castaway, which is a rigid elbow brace, both for pediatric and adult. The DEQ is a very unique thumb spica that we developed in open stay, so there was no pressure over the first dorsal compartment for patients with De Quervain's tenosynovitis. We have a family called Handcuffs that are a new option for metacarpal fractures. And most recently, we just launched a product called the TFO, which is the fracture orthoses, that is for urgent care or emergency walk-in clinic type setting to stabilize an acute injury or fracture to the hand and wrist. Along with those products, you know, we've made a multitude of product upgrades and improvements to existing products. So it's never dull. There's always something brewing. Helium Weber is known as an R&D company. We really pride ourselves on innovation and bringing new things to the market.
Right. You know, I was going to ask this a little bit later, but now seems a good time to ask about it. Any hints, any kind of teasers that you can offer out as to kind of what you're working on currently?
Sure. So the next product that's getting close to launch will be a new elbow, a product. It fits into our line. It's not the same as anything else we have, but it will complement a current family in our elbow line. So that's coming. And then not so much a teaser as much to just kind of say, you know, on that same lines, I would love to get after a hinged elbow orthoses as well.
So I guess one of the biggest challenges that I would think in managing kind of elbow presentations is that rotational element of the bones crossing one another at the elbow joint. Is that kind of part of the challenge of managing elbow presentations?
Sometimes it depends on if you're, you know, what you're doing with the wrist as well, because that particular rotation of forearm rotation, supination, pronation is really coming from the wrist. So, but the elbow is just kind of a complicated joint in general to brace because there's so many, variables that we deal with, you know, just the soft tissue on an arm varies so greatly, you know, on people. And so size and shape of the arm and then gravity, wanting things to kind of slide down the arm and how do you maintain positioning? And then when you put a hinge in, you know, there's so much pistoning and some rotation of the brace and migration. So there's a lot that goes into trying to get something on the elbow that stays on the elbow. Things don't like to stay there all that well, it seems.
Right. Now, you know, next question is a little unfair. I mean, it's like asking you, you know, does somebody have a favorite child? And of course, the answer is supposed to be no. But kind of within the family, are there certain devices that you're just, you know, especially proud of or that, you know, you feel have just been really, really successful at managing a particular presentation?
That is a hard question because I'm really proud of a lot of products in our line, which is how I ended up with Healy & Weber. You know, they're a smaller bracing company who has really taken a chance on upper extremity, really invested in upper extremity and said, hey, we're going to be the upper extremity people. Whereas a lot of the big bracing companies, you know, they look at these smaller upper extremity products and it just isn't a big enough slice of the pie to invest into. So because of that, as a result of that, we just have so many products that are worth being proud of. But if I have to pick out a couple, I would say the CMC Controller Plus, which I was not actually involved in the initial development. They were ready to launch that product right as I came on board. And it's a great product. I have been fortunate to work through a number of product upgrades on it to make it a little bit more user-friendly, a little material upgrades, things like that. And that is a particularly great product. CMC Arthritis.
I was going to ask, what does that address?
Yeah, so it addresses CMC arthritis, which is such a prevalent problem that it's a highly utilized brace. So it's been fun to, you know, get more feedback and utilization off of such a high volume product in the upper extremity. So that's a product that, you know, I frequently kind of refer to as my baby to the sales reps. They all laugh because they know I'm going to be asking questions and what they're doing with the CMC Controller Plus. Outside of that one, I would say the MTC I'm particularly proud of. That was the first product that I was able to sign a patent on. And, you know, that has been on the market for, gosh, we are probably going on close to 8-ish years. And it's still such a fun product to show people. And when doctors see it and they get it, it's just like an aha every time. And so that's really a rewarding feeling. And oftentimes they'll say, who thought of this? And it's just very fun to say it was me that thought of that. And so
I like to call those good days at the office.
Exactly. We all need those every now and then, right? And absolutely. The other one that I would probably toss into that is the DEQ, which is a very simple thumb brace designed for de Quervain's veins, tenosynovitis synovitis I mentioned earlier. And that came as a collaboration amongst several practitioners. But interestingly, you know, I spend a lot of time in the field and I would just so often have doctors say to me, what do you have a good brace for de Quervain's? And I always sort of stumbled because I'm always a clinician first. That'll never change for me. And so that good always kind of made me stutter because I didn't really think we had anything good for de Quervain's at the time. And so after hearing that and being asked that over and over and over, and then with some collaboration from some a PA and a couple of physicians that we work with, we were able to develop the DQ. And like I had said, we put that open stay in that brace, which created an open space over the tender area that we refer to as the first dorsal compartment. And it was just a game changer. It was very innovative. It was, again, people who are looking for a brace for that diagnosis, as soon as they see that and we say that, it's just like a light goes off, and it's been a really great product to fill that need. And so that's also been a really fun one to work through and launch.
So I had conversations, you know, multiple times because I find it super interesting with, you know, all sorts of our clinicians on the prosthetic side and on the orthotic side. And a lot of them come from, you know, a biomechanical background or an engineering background or a bioengineering background. And because each patient can present so uniquely, you know, they may have a general diagnosis, but you know, each one is specific and, you know, may have individual challenges. And I've often asked them this question. So I'll ask you the same question. When you're looking at developing a product, a new product, or maybe it's taking an existing product and making a modification to it, how do you approach that? Do you see the final device in your head and then work towards it? Or do you break down the individual elements that you need to add to a device and then build it piece by piece? So, you know, we need to, you know, mobilize this, we need to restrict this, we need to, you know, kind of support this. How do you approach this in kind of your own mind?
That's an interesting question. I think for me, it's a little bit of a combination of both. I'm a very, very visual person, so I can just sort of see things in my mind. And so when I work with engineering, sometimes they're like, yeah, what you're seeing doesn't really work that way. So in my mind, I can usually visualize and see where I want to land. And when that's a reasonable vision, I can usually communicate that back or create my own prototype or something, and then absolutely build those the fit, form, and function into that so that I have all of the features needed to accomplish the goal. But I would say I usually, in my mind, it kind of starts with what I envision and then plug in the pieces, and then the end result is an evolution typically from my original vision. It's hardly ever what I first imagined.
So what's the process in developing a new device? What's the kind of the you know, soup to nuts approach for creating something new or taking an existing and making a modification to it?
So I would say in the most simplified version, it usually starts with, I have an idea, and that could be me, that could be a doctor, that could be a therapist, that could be a cast tech. Somebody has an idea. And so we capture an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, so that we're all on the up and up. And from there, you know, we start discussions of what is that idea? What's it look like? What are the goals of it? What components are involved? Maybe, you know, what sort of manufacturing would be required? Any sort of specific materials that would be needed, that sort of thing. And then I try and do some market analysis. I start to try and figure out, what are we looking at or how many people could use this device? Or is it certain groups of people? Is this a regional need? Is this a, are there competitive products on the market? Is this another version of something that's already available? Or is this brand new, which we call those brand new things, blue ocean ideas? And so market analysis kind of puts together the information that I then share with my team so that we can kind of grade the idea. And we have a matrix that we use where we have weighted points that in the end, we kind of come up with a score that gives us an idea of how strong this idea is and if our investment is worth the potential ROI. And once it kind of passes that point of acceptance in the product development stage, we start, you know, developing prototypes. That can look like all kinds of things. That could start out with me and thermoplastics. That could be just a conversation with my seamstress, and she whips something up based on what I've described. And those prototypes just evolve over time and evaluation, and as we identify what works and what doesn't work. And eventually we get to a point that we have something that we think is probably pretty close to the originator's idea. And so we circle back with them and let them tell us what they think and where we're at. And this process just goes on and on and on, where we keep playing and messing and changing and modifying until we all land on something that we think is probably pretty reasonable. And when I say probably pretty reasonable, that's a lot of opportunity to know we aren't right. And so at that point, we'll start doing some clinical testing, getting some on patients for feedback. At the same time, we're simultaneously working on sourcing and manufacturing techniques so that we're getting an idea of what's this going to cost us to do this, because if it costs too much, it's not a product, unfortunately. And so there's a lot of moving pieces that are happening all at the same time. As we get closer to end design, where we think we've got it, apply for coding. We start with photo shoots and marketing and things like that, planning our launch. And then once we launch it, we have all of our training to do. So we train our sales force on the product and its features and benefits and how to sell it and conversations to have regarding the brace, some clinical applications and common questions or pushback that they might receive, and there we have a product.
I've had lots of conversations with some of the product developers for, you know, some of our manufacturers, and I had one in particular, an individual said, you know, if I knew what it was going to be like to be a product developer, I would have never done it. You know, the idea comes to you and you go through all of the steps that you just mentioned, and then you kind of, you know, launch this child of yours out into the cruel mean world, and, you know, immediately you're going to get back feedback, and they say, you know, you do have to develop a certain level of thick-skinnedness as it goes out. Have you had that experience?
A little bit. I feel like, not to, you know, be too proud of ourselves, but we are kind of the experts when it comes to upper extremity in the industry. You know, we've been fortunate to be able to bring so many things to market that nobody else has. And if anything, we oftentimes get accused of maybe over-engineering our products. And so I haven't had too much rejection in a way that you would feel like, ooh, ouch, I was, you know, not expecting that. However, I will say that oftentimes when we bring a new product to market, the reception is typically warm, but doctors oftentimes have their own ideas. So everybody has, not everybody, it's just common for somebody to say, this is great, but you should have done this, or, oh, this is great, but you should add this, you know, and it's always just kind of that little extra of, you almost got it. And when I first started, you know, in this role, I think that I was more sensitive to those sort of things. And now it's not that I'm, you know, non-sensitive to them, but I think I've just grown so much in the sense of understanding product development so much more, and understanding that there are so many considerations when you develop a product, that it's in most cases when those "yeah, but" comments come into us, it's not that we didn't think of those or that we didn't consider those. It's just simply that they weren't feasible in the process, or the investment into that, there was no ROI, or, you know, there's typically like a really good reason that we didn't do something that they're maybe mentioning or suggesting. So,
right. And for the reasons you made the decisions that you made.
Exactly. Yep. And so, if something is identified that we missed or we didn't think of, I will also say, like, we've gone back and made those improvements and consider them a product improvement. And, you know, we aren't too proud of ourselves to recognize when we've missed something and somebody else, you know, picked up on it. So we are for sure open. We want to be the best in what we do, and we don't care who gets the credit for that.
Yeah, and I guess it's an advantage to being kind of a smaller, tighter, leaner company, as opposed to kind of, you know, a much larger organization. I mean, a big boat takes a long time to change direction, whereas you can kind of filter in and accept those kind of feedbacks and so forth.
I think that's very true, yes.
So innovation in terms of kind of product development, How does that fit into kind of the approach that Helium Weber takes?
So, like I said earlier, you know, we really pride ourselves on saying Helium Weber is an R&D company. We love innovation, and by definition, you know, innovation is a new idea, method, or device. And so where we really shine is when we are able to do just that. Bring something new to the market. And I think that's why the upper extremity side of things has been so fun, because we've been able to bring so many blue ocean ideas out. It's harder to create something new or innovate something that already exists. You know, it's like, how many material changes or looks or, you know, hinge mechanisms or things can you do to try and refresh something that's already there? That has proven to be more difficult, at least for me, than really coming up with something that isn't there. And I think part of the excitement in that for me is, again, being a clinician at heart, is finding solutions. What do the patients want and need? What do the providers want and need? What is going to make their recovery faster or better, or make it easier and more comfortable for them? What is going to save providers time and energy and still offer superb care? And so that's where I think the innovation really fits in for us, is bringing those solutions, not just shining up old answers.
Right. I mean, that I guess kind of answers the next question that I wanted to ask you, is kind of, where do you see the future for kind of upper extremity devices and products and kind of hand therapy? Where do you see kind of, I mean, everything's evolving, and with, you know, more technology and so forth, how will that factor into kind of, you know, upper extremity future product development and just the field of upper extremity orthotic devices?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I wish I had a crystal ball sometimes. Some of my observations, I guess, just in the last, you know, 6 to 10 years, lead me to believe that the future is bright for upper extremity orthoses, particularly prefabricated. And it hurts my heart just a little bit to say that, coming from my hand therapy background and being so proud of our skill set to be able to custom fabricate and really the just satisfaction that has brought to my career, being able to have that skill set. It's really an art form to be able to do that. But medicine has changed so much where, you know, we're under so much more pressure to see patients in less amount of time. We might not have as many visits. Protocols are changing. Healthcare dollars are being squeezed. There's just so many things that have changed over the years, and that seems to be the direction and momentum of that change. And so I think that prefabricated bracing is really an excellent tool to work within some of those confines that providers are being faced with. You know, if you can pull a brace off a shelf that is going to be comfortable and provide the fit, form, and function that is needed to meet the demands of the particular diagnoses or a protocol, and you're able to dispense that and apply it within a couple of minutes, rather than custom fabricating the same sort of thing that may not be as comfortable because you're talking about rigid materials on the skin, and it's going to be take a lot more time, and the cost associated with that is much greater. You know, that these prefabricated options, because they're have evolved and we have some really great offerings, I think that they can fit a need for the providers to still offer really great care while saving time and money and not compromising care.
Right. So, you know, many of our, I would say the vast majority of our clinicians, you know, have come in multidisciplinary teams that they work with, whether it's within a hospital setting or within private clinics or kind of within their referral networks. Any thoughts as to kind of, you know, ideas as how some of our certified orthotists, you know, can work more effectively, efficiently, with kind of some of their occupational therapy colleagues or their kind of hand therapy kind of co-clinicians? Any thoughts on that?
You know, I probably don't have a lot to offer on that just because I've never had any personal experience with a lot of collaboration from hand therapy to O&P outside of the rare cases where we might have, you know, share a patient where they're actually working on a prosthesis and we're working on the rehab side of things. So I don't know if I can speak very intelligently to that, to be honest.
Maybe that's actually a great answer, that maybe there isn't as much collaboration between those particular teams as there could be.
Very possible. I think so much depends on, you know, clinical structures and referral patterns. And one thing I've learned traveling all over, you know, being in clinics coast to coast is you just never can assume how things are being done from one facility to another. And roles change depending on where you're at and who has the expertise and who's kind of taken things on and maybe developed programs and processes. So I think that, you know, the possibilities are endless.
Right. And how about kind of any thoughts again for our kind of clinicians as how they can kind of best kind of possibly either introduce or integrate some of the helium rubber products into their practice, whether it be a public practice or a private practice? Any thoughts of how kind of, you know, they could begin to integrate some of these innovative products?
Sure. I think any clinician who is seeing a patient who has any sort of upper extremity pathology, identifying what are some of those things that you commonly see and how are you helping those patients? And so we have a lot of diagnosis specific products, but we also have products that can be used, you know, across diagnoses. And so figuring out if you're seeing a lot of a certain thing, what of our products could be a help to your patient. Again, they can be prescribed and dispensed right from the clinical office. They are available retail as well. And really how I look at our stuff is not just selling a product, but providing a solution. And so if you are struggling finding something that brings your DeQuervain's patients some relief and rest, we've got something for that to make your life easier in that category. If you have a cast tech who is just running ragged and doesn't have time to make Munster casts, we have something that could save him or her a whole lot of time and still provide really great care for your patient. So I think it's just kind of identifying what are your needs, where are your pinch points? Is it, you know, are you short on time? Are you short on techs? Do you have a brace that people just don't wear because it's not comfortable? What is the pinch point? And then we could certainly identify how we could solve some of those problems.
I know, speaking from personal experience over the kind of the last few weeks, I know that I've fielded quite a few questions from some of our clinicians where I certainly don't know kind of in which direction to point them or how to be able to get assistance. And I know that I've called upon you kind of, you know, it's right back to rounds in school and say, okay, I've got this patient, this is how they present. What are your thoughts? And each time you've been able to kind of really direct me and say, okay, you know, this will manage that, or you may want to consider this, or if they have this as well, you know, and really kind of direct the conversation towards kind of narrowing down the options.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie, I would like to extend my deepest thanks to you for taking the time to join me on this podcast. I mean, you're a wealth of information. And I want to thank you for sharing some of that with us.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been fun.
And with that, thank you very much for listening to this episode. I'd like to thank Jamie McMillan from Helium Weber for stopping by to talk with us. Of course, if you have a show or a topic for future episodes you'd like to hear, you can email us at positiveoutcomes@orthoped.ca. New episodes are released every other Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts. Positive Outcomes is a production of Orthoped ULC in conjunction with our partners, produced by Jonathan Stone and Frederic Sauvé, and hosted by myself, Simon Beals, and Jeff Newell. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.